This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to the world today. I'm David Lipson. This Wednesday, the East Coast energy market set to resume normal operations, but it might be too late for some small energy retailers. Also, more of us are working, salaries are going up, but so is inflation. The Employment Minister Tony Burke joins us to explain whether workers will have to face a cut in real wages in the future. And grossly offensive public conduct. New laws being introduced in Victorian Parliament to target it, but civil liberty groups warn of overreach.
We're always concerned when there's a legislative response to single high-profile cases because there can be unintended consequences and eventually mission creep and an expansion of new offences over time.
Thanks for your company. First to the energy crisis and further signs it's easing for now. The Australian energy market operator will gradually hand back control of the wholesale market to energy companies. The market operator intervened to seize control of the spot market almost a week ago amidst supply shortages and the threat of blackouts on the East Coast. AEMO's chief executive, Daniel Westerman, says the operator is taking a staged approach to lifting the market suspension.
The first step will take place at the end of trading day today, and that is 4 a.m. tomorrow morning, when we'll allow the market to set the price again. The second step will happen 24 hours after that, when we'll be able to formally lift the market suspension.
Sarah McNamara is chief executive of the Australian Energy Council, which represents power generators. I spoke with her earlier. Sarah McNamara, from tomorrow, the market will start setting wholesale power prices again. Do you welcome this news?
Oh, we're delighted that the market operator is confident enough to start to move away from its decision to suspend the NEM. That's because there's been a clear improvement in market conditions.
Did you see the move that AEMO took, the unprecedented move, as completely necessary?
Oh, we've been in a very difficult situation in the market for a couple of weeks now. Sustained high prices caused a trigger which placed a price cap in the market Sunday before last. The challenge in a price cap environment is that the way dispatch rules work in the market are quite different, and it caused real anxiety and challenges for generators who had limited fuel stocks, who under the price capped rules were going to have to stay in the market and potentially run out of fuel. So that meant some generators last week were sitting on the sidelines by agreement with the market operator and waiting to be required by the market operator to dispatch into the market. That was sort of a workaround, I think, for what was a really challenging set of circumstances for them. And that's why the market operator stepped in to run the whole market itself, and we absolutely supported that decision. It took some pressure off everyone because it gave the market operator a very clear vision of who had which fuel stocks and which dispatch generators to move into the market at any given point in time in order to ensure there was enough supply.
Daniel Westerman from AEMO says he doesn't want to see a repeat of the dysfunction that you've just described. Now, you have in the past rejected claims that generators were withdrawing supply from the market to profiteer from the crisis. What will it take for generators to actually guarantee supply going forward?
Firstly, the reference Daniel Westerman, the head of the market operator, made to dysfunction last week was not a reference to generator behaviours. It was a reference to a market that was operating under a lot of stress and with pretty limited supply and an automatically triggered price cap. The price cap did not work well for anyone, and what will be helpful, I think, at the end of this period is for the market operator, the regulator and the industry to reflect back on how the rules have operated in this situation and what we might need to reform in order to ensure if there is a next time, and we certainly hope there isn't, that perhaps the market rules can be shaped in a way that works to support a more coordinated approach.
Do your members accept that they may have to put forward lower profits or even losses to ensure that the grid is stabilised in the future, or will they need to maintain those profits and in some cases big profits going forward?
It's not really a question of profits in this instance. I mean, during the price cap period, the price cap was set at $300 a megawatt hour, and gas-fired generators, for example, were finding their costs more in the order of $450 a megawatt hour. So there was the potential for very serious losses in the market just because of the scarcity of some coal and gas for different reasons. So it's just not a question of profits. It is important, though, that generators remain financially viable. We don't want to see sort of disorderly exit or businesses collapsing in the market, because what's really important for Australian homes and businesses is that the lights stay on. So generators do need to recover their costs. It has always been that way. Fortunately, though, most retail customers, households and small businesses don't pay the prices that you saw in the wholesale market over the last few weeks. And that's because retailers shield their customers from those wholesale spot market spikes through long-term hedging contracts, which smooths out the impact of any price increases.
That's Sarah McNamara, the Chief Executive of the Australian Energy Council. Well, while the market operator prepares to lift its suspension of the wholesale electricity market, Australia's energy crisis has already hit a number of small retailers. One of those folding under the pressure is Australia's first community-owned energy retailer, Enova, which has been placed into voluntary administration. Here's Matt Bamford.
It was a frank announcement that underscored an energy market in crisis. Enova Energy, Australia's first community-owned retailer with around 13,000 customers, has entered administration. Alison Crook is a former chairwoman.
A very sad day for staff, for shareholders, for the region, and for everybody who's interested in distributed, decentralised renewable energy and any sort of community involvement and ownership.
The company reinvested 50% of profits into community-owned renewable projects, energy efficiency and education services. Climate and Energy Minister Chris Bowen acknowledged their challenges today.
I know that Enova Energy entered a very difficult circumstance over the last 24 hours, which is disappointing for them and for all their customers. They're a good company, but we continue to monitor the situation very, very carefully and closely.
Giles Parkinson from Energy News website Renew Economy says it reveals the challenges for energy retailers right now.
Just highlights the difficulties there are in creating more competition in this market. I mean, Australia's electricity market has been dominated by the big players, the big so-called gentailers. We've seen a lot of small retailers emerged in the last couple of years. A lot of them, like Enova, are focused on 100% renewables. They're trying to do something different. They're trying to sort of create change. And in the current conditions, they're finding it absolutely impossible.
There's been some extreme measures taken in recent weeks, like Luke Blinko from Reamped Energy telling his customers to go elsewhere.
You're better off with another electricity retailer than us.
Because they have a small customer base and rely on generators, these retailers are exposed.
The problem is with these smaller retailers that, you know, we've got this funny structure in Australia where it is dominated by big players who are the biggest generators as well as the biggest retailers. And they basically play both sides of the market. You know, they have the power. If they're losing money on one side, they're usually winning on the other side.
The Australian energy market operator has struggled to convince generators to operate due to soaring energy costs. Faced with the possibility of blackouts along the East Coast, it took the extraordinary step of suspending the wholesale electricity market. A week later, it's preparing to lift the suspension. Tandem Energy analyst Rachel Bradanovich says that's not going to help small retailers.
Particularly some of the smaller ones who are trying to build their business on integrity and on customer service, you know, they make price commitments to their customers. So they will commit that this is your price for 12 months or whatever it might be, give or take a little bit of fluctuation, whereas the larger companies will just send you a notice and they'll say in your next bill, oh, by the way, we increased your price on this date and it's now that. So I think there's a real catch-22 for those smaller operators who really need to do the right thing to retain customers because they can't necessarily compete on price.
Giles Parkinson wonders whether the government can do more to help.
Maybe there needs to be protection for the small retailers. They're kind of stuck in between a rock and a hard place and nowhere to move. And maybe something can be done to help those because we need that extra competition in the market.
Today, Minister Chris Bowen was putting his faith in the regulators. But Tandem energy analyst Rachel Brajanovic says the market needs reform, starting with the generators.
So what we've seen is them saying, well, we can't make enough profit, so we are going to withdraw supply of this essential service. It's kind of just been, oh, well, that's their right to do that. And it's really come to a head at the moment. So I'm hoping that we start to seriously look at what they do and how they do it.
That's Tandem Energy analyst Rachel Brajanovic, ending that report by Matt Bamford. Well, there's been a mixed reaction to the Reserve Bank's inference yesterday that workers may have to cop a real wages cut to help keep a lid on inflation in the medium term. RBA boss Philip Lowe yesterday predicted inflation would rise to 7% by the end of the year, but he also warned wages growth above 3.5% would only prolong the cost of living pain due to inflation. Tony Burke is the Minister for Employment and Workplace Relations. He joined me earlier. Tony Burke, thanks for your time. Your government just last week welcomed a 5.2% increase in the minimum wage. The Reserve Bank Governor Philip Lowe is now suggesting that anything over about 3.5% will prolong high inflation. Did the government get it wrong by pushing for such an increase to the minimum wage?
Yeah, I think there's a bit of misreading going on of what the governor of the Reserve Bank said yesterday. Just hear me out here, David. Mm. In the first instance, what the governor said, he made no objection to that decision at all. That decision by the Fair Work Commission took inflationary pressures into account. What the governor of the Reserve Bank has referred to yesterday is if increases become common in the 4-5% range. Now, let's not forget where the wage price index is running across the whole economy. So not just this decision, but where it's running across the whole economy, it's been running at 2.4%. Mm. So the comments yesterday from the governor of the Reserve Bank still call for wages to get moving beyond where they have been. 3.5% that he's referred to is still a significant improvement on where things have been for the flatlining wages growth over the last decade.
So is that, would you be satisfied with that in the future, around 3.5% for minimum wage workers? Because the Reserve Bank's also forecasting 7% inflation. Would you repeat the calls that you made in the election for the lowest paid workers not to have to go backwards? Will they have to go backwards in the future?
Well, I think there's a significant gap between where inflation might peak and what underlying inflation's likely to be. I don't think anyone would argue that the 7% peak was going to reflect underlying inflation over the even the medium term. That's not the nature of what a peak is. The people who are on the lowest rates of pay are the people who, and the reason we made the submission, they simply, after a long period of flatlining wages, had nowhere to go. You know, these are the people who are least likely to have any savings. Mm. These are the people who spend all their money on essentials. So what exactly do you cut for those individuals?
Yeah, no, I don't think there's many people that would disagree with you that you know they would find it hardest to withstand a real wages cut. But the question is, was that a one-off? I mean, can we expect the government to be pushing for the lowest paid workers to have their wages set at around the inflation rate in the future?
We always said that particular submission that we made was based, every submission you base on the economic circumstances in front of you. Mm. And we have never said or implied that there'd be an ongoing matching at wherever headline inflation was. We've never said that. We've never implied that. That's never been our position. But we will always be mindful of what the impact is on for the people who have the least resources, mm. as you'd expect. And I do think there's been a significant, particularly in some of the print today, effectively wanting to recharacterise the words from the Reserve Bank governor.
Well, what he said was, if wage increases become common in the 4-5% range, then it's going to be harder to return inflation to 2.5%.
Now, just a few days ago, you said inflation's not being driven by high wage growth. Were you wrong there?
Well, at the moment, we don't have high wage growth. So nothing can be driven by high wage growth at the moment because we don't have it.
Increasingly, though, that is going to be happening, is what Philip Lowe said.
He's concerned about what might happen into the future, and we'll always take the economic advice that we have as to when we make submissions on future annual wage reviews and when we set different settings. Like, of course we'll do that. You wouldn't expect the government to do anything but that.
So you concede then that wages growth above around 3.5% will prolong this period of high inflation and drive up interest rates as well?
Well, even with what you've just said there, you've gone further than what the governor of the Reserve Bank said. The governor of the Reserve Bank, in the quote you just gave, was if they become common in that 4 to 5% range. He's referring to the medium and long term. He has not made a reference to what might be around in the immediate term. And effectively, it's a warning that everybody needs to be aware of, that we want inflation to get back within the target band of 2 to 3%. And the argument that we have always put is actually an argument that came from both the Secretary of Treasury and the Governor of the Reserve Bank, which is that wages are not inflationary if they run at inflation plus productivity. Now, he's saying inflation to get within that target band of 2.5, and the productivity has been running at about 1%. That gets you to the 3.5 that he's been talking about. But once again, even that is a far cry from what Australian workers have been dealing with the wage price index running at 2.4%.
Tony Burke, we'll have to leave it there. Thanks for talking to us.
Great to talk to you. Thanks, David.
And Tony Burke is the Minister for Employment and Workplace Relations. An extended interview will be on the World Today website. On ABC Radio across Australia, streaming online and on the ABC Listen app, this is The World Today. Thanks very much for your company. The Federal Workplace Watchdog has put 11 universities on notice for potentially underpaying staff, warning those who don't cooperate will face court action. Wage theft revelations have plagued universities for years, with unions saying millions of dollars have been recovered so far from more than 20 institutions. Well, the Fair Work Ombudsman denies university payment systems are completely broken, but admits it will be a long road to recovery. Here's Stephanie Smale.
After years of issues with their pay packets, Sarah Roberts from the National Tertiary Education Union in Victoria says university staff are fed up and struggling.
Despite the flavour that we have in our community about university staff kind of being, well off and highfalutin, it's absolutely not the case for these people. And, you know, I'm talking about people who struggle to make rent, struggle to feed themselves, and especially over the summer holidays period, really just have difficulty existing.
The union says the issues are systemic and widespread, with more than $25 million recovered so far from 23 universities. The Fair Work Ombudsman, Sandra Parker, agrees there's a trend and says it's time for universities to pick up their game.
I do think that the public, and certainly we, the regulator, should be able to have an expectation that they get it right. I actually don't think taxpayers' funds should be going on helping companies audit their own payroll or helping them to get their payments right in terms of wages. I actually think that's their job, and they all have boards. So where are the boards, and why aren't they holding these universities to account?
11 universities are under investigation, and Sandra Parker says she's working well with most of them.
If they are going to be more difficult about it, resist working with us, withhold information about how they're calculating the back payments, etc., they're not talking to their staff about it and being pretty upfront about it, we won't hesitate to take compliance and enforcement action. So that ranges right through to taking them to court.
Are many universities resisting?
We have a couple that we expect to result in high-end enforcement outcomes. I can't comment on the actual investigations at this stage, but the majority of them are cooperating.
Sandra Parker denies the university systems are completely broken. She says they need to centralise human resources and improve investment, make sure all faculties have the same system, and invest in better payroll and time recording.
Most of this is neglect. They haven't thought it's been an issue. I can't imagine that any university has deliberately set out to say, let's underpay workers. That's not how it works. It happens over time. Things go wrong. Different schools start doing their own thing. It's a long road, but it is certainly fixable.
Sarah Roberts from the National Tertiary Education Union warns the union will keep up pressure on universities that don't do the right thing. But she argues it's time for a broader look at how universities are run.
We'd say it's time for an independent review of university governance. I mean, how is this happening in our community? So we would be saying to the Victorian Parliament and to the Federal Parliament, you should be looking at this and thinking about an independent inquiry into university governance.
That's Sarah Roberts there from the National Tertiary Education Union, ending that report by Stephanie Smale. New laws criminalising grossly offensive public conduct will be introduced into Victorian Parliament today following the events surrounding an horrific car crash in 2020. Four police officers were killed in the incident after stopping to pull over Porsche driver Richard Pusey, who filmed the aftermath of the crash. Family members of the police officers have welcomed the new laws, but civil liberties groups are warning criminalising offensive conduct could lead to government overreach. As Oliver Gordon explains.
Widower Stuart Schultz doesn't feel comfortable using the name of the person who filmed his dying wife, leading Senior Constable Lynette Taylor.
No, I don't use his name. I haven't spoken his name for 2.5 years.
In April 2020, Richard Pusey was pulled over by police on the Eastern Freeway. Four of the police who were involved in pulling over Mr. Pusey were then killed when a truck came off the road. At this point, Richard Pusey pulled out his phone and started filming, providing offensive commentary in the process. Pusey was eventually sentenced to 10 months prison after pleading guilty to a number of charges, including the controversial charge of outraging public decency. Widower Stuart Schultz doesn't believe the sentence Pusey was handed down was adequate.
That was the most disappointing part of our whole process so far, was that the court finding and the sentence.
Today, in response to this incident, the Victorian Parliament will consider new laws that would create a new statutory offence of engaging in conduct that is grossly offensive to community standards of behaviour. If passed, the offence would have a maximum penalty of up to 5 years imprisonment. Victorian Attorney General Jacqueline Symes told ABC Radio Melbourne this morning the new offence will strengthen the outdated offence, outraging public decency, Richard Pusey was charged with.
What this new offence does is modernise that offence to make it more fit for purpose and up to date with community standards.
The Victorian Attorney General says Richard Pusey's actions on the Eastern Freeway proved there was a gap in the law that needed fixing.
This law is fixing a very, very small gap. If this offence is never used, that will make me very happy. If there is an offence, someone does something of that level, the gap no longer exists, and the police and the courts have an appropriate response.
She says she wants legislation to be able to better deal with incidents that elicit widespread public outcry.
This gap was the behaviour of one individual that led to a public outcry of what he did on that day. That gives a pretty strong suggestion of the types of behaviour that we want to make sure that the courts are given an opportunity to respond to.
But civil liberties groups have been quick to point out that public outcry is not a good reason to introduce legislation.
We're always concerned when there's a legislative response to single high-profile cases. We understand the outrage that Mr. Pusey's conduct caused the community and the families of the deceased police officers, but he's been dealt with by the criminal law and sentenced in relation to his conduct. We're always cautious when it comes to expanding the criminal law because there can be unintended consequences and eventually mission creep and an expansion of new offences over time. We've seen that time and time again.
That's Liberty Victoria President Michael Stanton. He says they'll be watching the passage of the bill closely.
There's a famous maxim that hard cases make bad law. We would be concerned about how the criminalisation of grossly offensive conduct could be utilised in the future in other cases, how the test could be expanded and changed, and particularly how that might be used in relation to vulnerable members of the community.
That's Liberty Victoria President Michael Stanton, ending that report by Oliver Gordon.
And that's all from the World Today team for this Wednesday. Linda Mottram and the PM team will be along this evening with everything you need to know about stories from across Australia and the world. Thank you very much for your company. I hope you can join us at the same time tomorrow. I'm David Lipson. Have a very good afternoon.
Hey, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. This week, the world governing body for swimming, FINA, controversially banned transgender women from the highest levels of competition. While some of Australia's most successful swimmers welcomed the ruling, it was a devastating blow for the transgender community, with other sports signalling they'll follow FINA's lead. Today, Tracy Holmes from ABC Sport on a divisive debate ahead and what it means for transgender athletes. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. You can discover more ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.